Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
So, Richie Neal, we're approaching the anniversary of the death of JFK all those years ago. What does it mean to you?
Well, I was actually in the crowd on the day before the election in 1960 at Springfield, City Hall.
Yeah.
And what was striking about that, if you remember, he did a visit to Springfield, and then he moved to Waterbury, Connecticut, I believe, and it was back to Boston that night to finish the campaign. But I recall seeing him and that very graceful manner. I think the psychological impact of John Kennedy is what remains with us, in the sense that today, as there has been since his election, there are literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who sought public office or came to the belief that government service was honorable and that you could have an impact by entering government, and a sense of idealism, I think, that really was triumphant at the time. And so that memory, I think, that grips us is never just the assassination. It's that sense of idealism that he brought to public service.
There are so many people now writing books about him and saying the women, this, that, the diseases we didn't know about, the Addisons and all the rest of it. And yet there is the story of the West Virginia homeowner who had a picture of Jesus on one wall and JFK on the other, and Lyndon Johnson saying, you know, I could never get that done.
Well, remember that what's striking about that Kennedy candidacy in 1960, in addition to all of the other items, is that 25% of the American people said they could not vote for a Roman Catholic.
Indeed.
To be president. What's striking about that in West Virginia, in particular, was the fact that John L. Lewis, the head of the miners' union,
Indeed.
He was against Kennedy.
Yep.
In a state that was 95% Protestant, Kennedy had almost a mystical moment, won that primary, and after that, you might argue that it was uphill for his competitors. I think Robert Dallek really did a great job with his book, and I thought that Dallek's appearance in the PBS series recently was very instructive. And Dallek is the one who has written, I think, conclusively about Kennedy's ailments, and there's no question that it was Addison's disease that was the issue that hobbled him. And there was irritable bowel syndrome. There were a number of other parts of his physical stature that had been impacted. But I also think that the public understands proportionality. And they measure that against what they believe, again, to have been the Cuban Missile Crisis, the manner in which it was handled, the manner in which he introduced the Alliance for Progress. I think that today, across America, there are thousands and thousands of alums who participated in the Peace Corps. And given even the fact that he was not able to attain major civil rights legislation or Medicare, nonetheless, I think it's fair to say he set in motion the momentum that eventually brought about those initiatives. And I don't know, I don't think there's anybody who said that Jack Kennedy had the legislative skill of Lyndon Johnson. But at the same time, there was a certain elan and an attraction that we had that brought, again, people to public life in that can-do spirit.
The Warren Commission, of course, reported, said lone gunman and all the rest. I have trouble with it. I wonder about you.
Well, I subscribe to the theory that there was a lone gunman. I knew Lou
yeah.
Stokes. He served with me in Congress. He was a member of the Warren Commission. I talked to him many times about it. And in retrospect, one of the things that stands out in my mind is the following, that Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General of the United States. And knowing the deep sense of depression that he went through afterwards, I can't imagine that there would have been any stone left unturned by the Attorney General of the United States in an effort to seek out a wider conspiracy if, in fact, it had happened. And my point is that I think that one of the great difficulties with the Kennedy assassination, it triggered a sense of now a conspiracy about virtually every big issue in question in America. And I think the conspiracy theorists have had a day, and as you noted, the ubiquitous nature of the writings and the TV viewings and the radio broadcasts of the Kennedy assassination remind us that America was a much more simple place to live before mm-hmm. the assassination.
Sure. We have a video of him in upstate New York here in Albany riding in an open car. You know, just very scary. Could have happened anywhere else, except that I agree with you that it was a lone gunman. But I knew a union official, a Teamster, who told me before his death that, quote, we killed one, we're going to kill the other one. Now, I've always thought he's a bit of a BSer, to be honest with you, and a braggart. But, you know, there are so many possibilities here as to who got to Oswald. And I've always felt, you know, with Jack Ruby standing there, that was just too much. That strained every bit of credibility, you know, that I had that that could have happened.
Millions of other Americans, I actually watched live Ruby's fatal shot of Oswald. And I recall that at that moment, everybody thought that there had been a conspiracy. And but when you have a chance to sort the case that Jim Garrison brought, you can see how ludicrous it was and how many reputations were damaged because of Garrison's meandering through inaccuracies. And I think in that sense, having known people of the stature of Lou Stokes, who reviewed the Warren Commission report, I should have suggested, people like that, including the Kennedy family, I can't believe for a moment that they would not have pursued every opportunity if there was a suggestion that this had been a wider conspiracy.
As long as you open that door, Richie Neal, there was bad blood between Johnson and Kennedy. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I've read all the four volumes that Robert Caro has offered up, and I must tell you, in pursuit of scholarship, I think that Caro has done a great service to America. And it's my understanding that the Johnson family is going to cooperate in the fifth volume. And as you know, they did not cooperate in the early volumes. But there were two very distinct moments, I think, that are important in that relationship. First, Johnson's decision not to engage the primaries in 1960. And Johnson, using the argument that legislative skills were the most important ingredient in a successful president. And here's John Kennedy, who's suggesting that there's something that's perhaps wider, more esoteric, more of a leadership quality that the public comes to view, the better application of words, for example, to create an image. I think all of that's important. But I don't know that anybody has done a better job of dissecting that relationship than Robert Caro. And I think that one thing that can be said is it would have been, I think, successfully argued that perhaps President Kennedy could have used Vice President Johnson in a more meaningful way in terms of selling legislation. Recall that Rayburn liked Johnson, Richard Russell liked Johnson, and in fact, it was Johnson that brought the Southerners to heel over the civil rights law, and not to miss the point that he also helped to convince Everett Dirksen, the Republican Senate leader, to vote for the civil rights law. You have this period between 64 and 68, which has got to be a golden age in a lot of ways of legislative achievement. Civil rights, voting rights, fair housing, Medicare, Medicaid. And I think that by that time you set the stage for EPA and you also set the stage for the Wilderness Act, even although they were implemented by a succeeding president. So it's a can-do moment in American history, but not to miss the point that I don't know that it was ill will as much as it was the competition of the two in 1960, and then Johnson's notion that he had superior legislative skill and should have been utilized in a more far-reaching manner.
Johnson, to me, and having read Caro, talking to Doris Kearns Goodwin about all this, I don't know how to put this, but he was a grotesque sort of figure compared to JFK.
Well, again, there's the one was 43 years old and had boyish good looks and had a fabulous story to tell about what had happened in just a couple of generations. And one of the difficulties for Lyndon Johnson was that he had attended a state teacher's college. He had grown up in poverty and came to Washington, a real believer in the New Deal, a subscriber to the idea of what government could do, understood the levers of politics and policy. And not to miss the point that even though some might argue it was a Machiavellian moment, it was Johnson that introduced a major civil rights bill in 1957.
Indeed.
And that point is frequently missed. And part of it was obviously to appeal to the left in the Democratic Party and the editorial rooms across the country. He never joined the Southern Caucus. because he knew that that might inhibit his ability to get to the White House. But there's a very different subset here of skill. And one is selling legislation and making legislation work. And to be very frank, I think that President Obama has come to the conclusion that it's not just about making speeches.
Oh, yeah.
It's about sitting in a room for days and days and days, if not weeks and years, trying to get a deal hammered out. And it is not very glamorous.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Obamacare. We'll see what you make of all of that mess, okay?
Thank you very much.